In the fourth lesson of this audio course on Lean UX, we look at how to create a user-centric information architecture in a fast and efficient way. This course is free thanks to the support of Balsamiq. Hello and welcome to this audio course on Lean UX. This course is hosted by myself, Paul Boag, and joining me is Marcus Lillington. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul. So we're still calling it a course, are we?
Oh, I don't know. Yes. It still makes a course. I tell you what. At the end of this course is 12 episodes over a year. I am not even going to try and do this again because you have completely wrecked the idea.
I've just really enjoyed doing the interview so far. It's been very eye-opening's too strong. That's like, wow, I've come, you know,
yeah,
a
my
brand
life
new
has
experience.
Been changed. Yeah,
exactly. Not that strong, but it's just been, I've enjoyed it. I've liked how willing people are to come along and do it,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
That's because you're internet famous, Paul Barrick, you see.
I don't think it is. I think it's more that it's kind of quite fun having a chat with, you know, with people. You got a really good one this week. I really enjoyed it. It was with Abby Covert, because we're talking about, I should say, we're talking about information architecture this week.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to talk to Abby Covert, because who else do you talk to about information architecture?
Quite.
So it's a good one.
She's obviously super busy, because I sent her an email and I got nothing. And it was like, okay. And then I got this really friendly sort of, oh, I'd love to email about 2 weeks later.
Right.
So it's like, So I was about to start trying other people. And there are no other information architects in the world.
Not on her level. I've got to say, so for the people who don't know, Abby Covert works at Etsy now, and they talk about that in the interview, but she also wrote a really good book called How to Make Sense of Any Mess, isn't it? I think that's
something
what
like
it was
that
called.
Yeah, and that's basically it. IA, that's what IA is. And you say one thing in your you say more than one thing, but one thing that really resonated with me, come on to when we go on to your talk, you said one thing that I'm going, yes,
cool.
Yes. But Paul, I look forward to hearing
what that is.
How's business? Because business is just weird at the moment for us. We've never been more busy from a maintenance point of view, but sort of all, not all the big things, but most of the big things are not that we're not winning them. They're just not, they're just floating, waiting in the air, you know, for sort of, I don't know what.
Yeah. I mean, for most of the people I coach, it's pretty similar to what you've just described.
Mm.
But for me at this exact moment, I don't have anything, which is weird, right? But that's not a problem in my case, because I'm just going to do a course next month, a workshop next month, so you know, I can make my own stuff, you know, because of the way I work. But no, I've not, you know, not got any big projects, but I've been really busy this month. It's just next month I've got nothing. It's just all like you say, it's all over the place. It's just very peculiar. But
yeah, exactly that. It seems like there's tons of stuff and then nothing, and then tons of stuff again. We've got loads of opportunities at the moment, which I just, you know, 2 months ago there was literally nothing.
Yeah.
It's like, and now there's loads of opportunity. Obviously you've got to win them, but they need to become a real thing. This is a thing that I've experiencing at the moment, particularly with existing clients. I'll get an email or a phone call and it'll be like, really important thing that we need to talk to you about, very important, get everyone around the table kind of thing, the virtual table. And then when it comes down to, yeah, okay, great, and we do all the stuff, but then we start talking about price, they go, oh, well, we haven't really got any budget. Okay, well, we weren't going to do this for free kind of thing. So, yeah, it just seems to be that, yeah, people are keen to do stuff, but those holding purse strings are being very, understandably, hesitant, I suppose, to spend.
Yeah. Anyway, should we talk about this?
Yes, sorry, I was off on a proper tangent as ever.
No, I think it's nice for people listening to this, because obviously a lot of people listening to this are freelancers or agencies, and it's nice to know you're not alone, you know, or maybe even that you're doing better than Headscape, you know, which is obviously, you know, that would be an amazing achievement. Sorry.
Maybe. I don't know. We're doing all right.
But let's talk about this show and what we're going to be covering. So in the last lesson, we talked about value propositions. In this one, we're going to be talking about information architecture and how to go about doing it in a reasonably fast and efficient way that avoids endless politics and endless debates, right? So I'm going to talk a little bit about my process and how I go about doing it. Not that necessarily you have to do it in the same way. But then we've also got Marcus that's doing a little interview. A patronizingly small interview with Abby Covert. So we've got that coming on later as well. We've also got our little aside that we do, which is a little interview this time with Leon from Balsamic, where we're going to be talking about how people other than designers need to be doing wireframing and some ways of getting started in that. So if you're interested in following this season as a whole and the course as a whole, you can find out more by going to boag.world/lean-UX. The other thing that I just wanted to quickly mention, I'm investing a lot of time and effort in my newsletter these days, doing more and more content in that, more and more advice and stuff like that. So if you're not already subscribed to the newsletter, it's worth checking it out at subscribe.boagworld.com. And the reason I mention it in particular in relationship to this show is that I'm giving away, for anybody that signs up to this, to the newsletter, a copy of my book, The User Experience Revolution, which is about how to build user-centric cultures and how to introduce lean UX into organizations. So it's very relevant to this season. And you'll also, if you're a designer, you get a little mini course on how to get design approval as well. So that's subscribe.boagworld.com. Right. Should we start with my little talk, Marcus? I've got a little talk as well.
We've got little talks, little interviews, talk. Little everything. It's a little show this week.
Let's do that then. Okay, so let's talk about information architecture, because creating the information architecture for a website can be fraught with problems, especially on larger sites. Fortunately, I might have a bit of a process that can help you with that, because one of the biggest challenges faced by those working on larger websites is information architecture. Big organizations tend to have more offerings, more stakeholders, and a lot to say. And it's not unusual for me to work with organizations that have got hundreds of thousands of pages online. And creating an information architecture in an environment like that feels like a daunting, if not impossible, prospect. Fortunately, it doesn't need to be quite as horrendous as it first appears, and it is possible to create an information architecture effectively without getting too bogged down in endless debate. However, more importantly, you can create one that actually helps users find the content they need. So let's begin by looking at specifically what goes wrong with information architecture for larger organizations. Three issues regularly undermine the information architecture of any website, and we need to understand what those issues are so that we know how to combat them when we implement a process for developing a site structure. These three issues are politics, the wrong mental model, and starting from pre-existing site structures. Let's start with the politics. Many parts of an organization have messages that they wish to communicate online, and that means that there are many stakeholders when it comes to information architecture. To make matters worse, because most organizations work in departmental silos, each stakeholder has a very narrow view of the organization and often ends up seeing their perspective as more valid or more important than anybody else's. That can sometimes result into conflict over who gets the highest profile in the information architecture. This kind of siloed thinking can also lead to our second problem area, where things go wrong, the site being structured around the wrong mental model. As each silo fights for territory, it often results in the website being carved up into sections, with each silo owning one section of the website. Now, the problem with this approach is that organizational structures rarely match how a user thinks or how they wish to engage with an organization. This problem is made worse by the fact that internal stakeholders are experts in the subject of the site. And the more knowledgeable we become about something, the more our thinking about that subject diverges from the majority of the population. The result is that we end up with a website that makes no sense to the user and fails to match their mental model of the subject. Because of the size and complexity of the problem, many are tempted to avoid the issue entirely. Site owners end up migrating the content and site structure across from a previous iteration of the website and then merely making a few tweaks. And although this approach is entirely understandable, and I would be tempted to do the same thing, it only succeeds in compounding the problem. Over time, more layers of changes are made to the information architecture until it all ends up as an unnavigable mess. Sooner or later, you're going to have to fix the problem. Also, almost certainly, any information architecture you already have suffers from the same political and mental model problems I've previously mentioned anyway. So, now we understand the problem. What are we going to do to solve it? Well, the secret lies in having a robust process focused on the user and the content, not on the stakeholder and internal structure. A method that can validate any decisions that are made so that we have data to back up our decisions and avoid endless debate. Now, what process you adopt is entirely up to you. There's no magical solution here. However, I've personally got a five-step process that I use to create robust information architectures, and that's what I want to share with you. So let's begin with step one, which is defining your content. Now, it may be obvious, but before you can create your information architecture, you first need to know what content you wish to communicate. And it's surprising. Too often, I encounter teams creating an information architecture with only an abstract sense of the content that they wish to cover. Instead, you need to identify specific content types before you start. And these content types typically fall into four areas. When I start gathering the content for my information architecture, I begin by looking at the benefits. How do the products or services this company offer help end users? I list each benefit separately and maybe even bullet point a few thoughts on each benefit too. Next, I look at features of the products or services that the company offer. In other words, how does it deliver the benefits it promises? Again, I list each of these separately. Now, if the company offers multiple products and services, I repeat the exercise for each and the company as a whole. Then I turn my attention to functionality. What does the user need to be able to do on the website? That will include everything from logging in to recovering a password to contacting the company or signing up to a newsletter. Finally, I ask myself about objections. What questions or concerns might a user have about the products or services the company offers? What might stop them completing a task on the website? At this point, it might be worth pausing to explain how I go about collecting all of these content areas. Some brainstorming will be enough to get you started, but don't stop there. Looking at the existing website can be a great source of inspiration, as can offline promotional material. However, speak to customer-facing staff too. What benefits do the sales team focus on, or what objections do they commonly hear? What about those customer support teams? What questions do they get asked? Running a simple survey on your existing website is also a useful way of gathering insights into what your user wishes to do or what questions they need answering. You could also try looking at social media channels as well. Finally, run workshop sessions where you ask users to brainstorm questions or tasks that they might have, and that can be used to further expand your list. The result of all this research should be an impressively long list of possible things that somebody might want to do or know when visiting your website. However, not all questions and tasks are equal. Some things will be more important to users than others, and it's essential to identify what those are, as that will inform your visual hierarchy and site information architecture. And that's where top task analysis can help, which brings us on to step number two, carrying out top task analysis. Top task analysis is a process developed by a guy called Jerry McGovern to help identify the things that users most care about on a website. Jerry discovered that the majority of users actually only care about a small subset of the content that exists on any particular website. However, they often find it hard to locate that content because they're distracted by a plethora of other information. To avoid this problem, we need to identify what those top tasks are, the things that users most care about and want to know. The first step in top task analysis is to gather all of your potential tasks that you might that a user might want to complete. And that's what we did in step one. Following that, we need to reduce that list down to something a little bit more manageable. Creating that shortlist of potential tasks and questions is principally about removing duplicates and combining overlaps. Also, try to avoid things that aren't really tasks or questions. A typical example might be knowledge base, which is too broad to actually be meaningful. It's not really a content type. Finally, keep your tasks universal. Don't start adding tasks and questions that are really specific to an individual audience at this stage. Your final shortlist will vary in length, but try to keep it under about 100 items if at all possible. That's because the next step is to survey users and find out which ones they most care about. Now, typically this involves either posting a survey via your website or social media or sending out an email. Whatever the case, you're asking participants to rank their top five tasks by giving 5 points to the most important one, 4 to the next most important, and so on. Now, at face value, this seems like madness. Asking users to select between potentially 100 different options and rank them seems like too much. And in a sense, you're correct. The reason that this approach works is the very fact that it overwhelms users. There's just too much information for them to go through each result individually and assess whether it matters to them or not. Instead, they're forced to ask themselves what they want to do and then search the list to find it. And that prevents the tasks from influencing them too much. What you'll find when you look at the results is that a small proportion of the tasks get the vast majority of votes. These are the top tasks, and they are the elements that you build your information architecture around. They're also what you're going to use in your card sorting exercise, which is step three. With our prioritized list of tasks, it's now time to start structuring the information architecture around them. Instead of us trying to do this, we're going to get the user involved in the process through a card sorting exercise. Getting users to do this avoids any politics coming into play and ensures that the site is organized around their mental model rather than internal organizational structures. Now, if you haven't done card sorting before, don't worry, it's very straightforward. The first step is to basically print out no more than 30 top tasks on separate index cards. Next, we're going to ask users to sort the cards into groups. They can sort the cards in any way that makes sense to them. You could also, if you want, use an online tool like UXOps, or you could do it in person with people individually or even in groups. Once you've sorted the cards into piles, ask them to label those groups with whatever titles make most sense to them. That will give you some inspiration for the labeling of sections in the information architecture. Regarding how many people you get to do this exercise, well, that depends on your available time. Even doing this activity with 5 or 6 people is better than nothing, but the more you survey, the better. An open card sorting exercise won't leave you with a perfect top-level information architecture, but it will leave you with lots more informed information about how the user views things and give you at least some idea about how sections should be labeled. We can then move on to step 4. With the card sorting exercise complete, we can now create a draft information architecture based on what we've learned. That is not going to be an exact science, I'll be honest with you, but the open card sorting exercise should help you avoid some common pitfalls of making information architecture too organizational centric. It will also give you some ammunition to combat any political pressure that you're under. Where possible, use the labeling and grouping created by users in the card sorting exercise, but don't feel constrained by it. After all, you're going to have many more tasks and questions to organize than you showed to users, so some change is going to be required. Once you've created a draft information architecture, we still need to really validate its effectiveness with users through another card sorting exercise. Still, this time, we're going to take a slightly different approach. Instead of the previous approach, we're going to do what's called a closed card sorting exercise. This time, we're going to print out more cards. Feel free to print out as many as 60 cards, each with a task, a benefit, feature, objection, or question printed on them. Now we're going to ask users to organize the cards again, but this time, we're going to ask them to arrange the cards into a series of groups that we predefined at the start of the exercise. Each bucket will relate to a top-level section of the site. By doing this, we can validate whether the top-level information architecture matches the user mental model. If the user puts an index card in the same group as you intended, you know that the information architecture works. If they don't, or just can't find a place for a specific card, you know you've got some work to do. Now, by this point, we are able to move on to step five, because you should be reasonably confident in your top-level information architecture. However, the deeper into the site you get, probably the less well-defined it's going to be. So at this point, I usually start creating the information architecture I've planned within a content management system in order to build a very basic prototype. Also, by building it in the content management system you're eventually going to be using anyway, you're going to save yourself some migration work further down the line. Now, often this site or prototype or whatever we want to call it has no real design at this point, but at least it will allow users to navigate between pages so I can test my information architecture. Now, if your CMS is just not ready, that's fine. You can use another tool like, say, Notion to create interlinking pages. And that allows you to start assigning each task, benefit, feature, objection, or question to a specific page. Now, what you're going to end up with is your site structure and a whole load of individual pages. Each page will probably have several bullet points on it showing whatever content will be addressed on that specific page. We can then start to test this prototype by asking people to find a specific piece of information on a particular page. This step is essential because not every feature, benefit, etc. will necessarily have a whole page dedicated to it. That means we need to be sure that people can find a specific piece of content, even if it's on a page with other content buried in a particular section of the website. You could use a tool like Maze.design to carry out this kind of testing. Maze is an excellent choice because it offers unfacilitated as well as facilitated testing so that you can get statistically significant results. For example, Maze can give you data on how long, on average, it took somebody to complete a task and find a piece of content, or how many mistakes they made on the way. And that is valuable when attempting to get an internal sign-off. Now, I'm very conscious that the process that I've outlined in this little talk skips over a lot of details. So before I wrap up, I want to leave you with seven quick-fire tips that should help you create your information architecture. Are you ready? Then let's go. Number one, don't try to be logical. A lot of people think information architecture is about organizing things logically. It's not. It's about organizing things in a way that feels intuitive and matches the way people hold information in their heads. If information architecture were about organizing things logically, your supermarket would put tomatoes with fruits and not in the salad aisle. Number two, use the power of cross-linking. When faced with multiple places that a piece of content could be placed, don't waste too much time agonizing over it. Just pick one and then add a link from the other section to the content as well. In fact, make extensive use of cross-linking across your entire site. We often get hung up on site structure, but other forms of linking are just as necessary. Which brings me on to number three, make use of dedicated landing pages. Not everything has to fit neatly into your site structure. For example, I make heavy use of landing pages. These pages can be tailored to specific topics or help a particular audience that doesn't fit nicely into the overall site structure. You can use these pages to provide links to relevant content that may be scattered across the entire site. Next up, avoid catch-all sections. Where possible, avoid sections that lack a well-defined purpose. For example, About Us sections are somewhat ambiguous. After all, the entire website is about the organization. Another example is frequently asked questions. Surely the whole website is about answering frequently asked questions. Now, the problem with these kinds of sections is twofold. First is that these sections become dumping grounds for content people don't know where else to put it. So these sections quickly become bloated, which makes our second problem even worse, which is that they distract users. When a user struggles to see where a piece of content might fit, they're drawn into these catch-all sections out of desperation. They end up saying something like, perhaps it's in About Us, and then they get lost down that rabbit hole. A similar problem occurs when sections are not distinct from one another, which is my next tip. Make section labels clear and distinct. I once carried out some usability testing on a university website using a group of school leavers looking to go to university for the first time. I asked them to complete a particular task relating to their application process, and somehow they kept ending up in the alumni section. When I asked them why they ended up in a section that's really dedicated to those who've already been to university, they explained that they didn't know what the word alumni meant, and so they thought it might be somewhere worth trying. It might have the content that they wanted. Unclear labelling can confuse, even if it's not meant for a particular audience. Another related problem is that two or more section labels that are too similar can cause real issues. For example, I've encountered sites that have top-level navigation of solutions and services. Could you tell me the difference between those two? You're better off having fewer top-level sections so you can make them more distinct, which brings me on to not obsessing about the number of clicks. Many sites end up with way too many options on any particular level because they feel that their site has to in somehow reduce the number of clicks a user has to make in order to find content. Although this was required in the past when connection speeds were horrendously slow, it's rarely the case anymore. What users care more about is that they're confident they're heading in the right direction, not how many clicks it takes to get there. By letting go of the idea that you need to minimize the number of clicks, you can make menus more scannable and give the user more confidence that they're on the right path. My final tip is to disclose more details the deeper the user goes in the site. You need to think of your site structure as relating to the specificity of the content. The deeper into the user goes into the site, the more specific the content becomes. This allows you to avoid overwhelming users with details that are either not relevant to them or they just don't want it now. It also puts the user in control. They can drill down to whatever level of information they want. So there you have it. That's how I approach information architecture. I can't say it's a comprehensive guide, but it should be a good solid starting point for content creation. If you've got any questions, by all means, reach out to me on email. You can email paul@boagworld.com and I will do my best to help you out. So I think it's very important, Marcus, that we jump immediately into what I said that has changed your life and revolutionized everything you believe.
It was quite near the end when you said, don't try and make sense. Don't try and make your information architecture logical. Mm-hmm. I've thought I must get, because you know, like designers have T-shirts with stuff written on them.
Yeah.
I need one that says information architecture does not line up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it doesn't. We're all a little bit guilty of trying to sort of make sure that everything's got the same amount of things in it and there's a nice even number of things here. And actually, that's not what it's about because it's not a design exercise. So that was the one that I really liked. I was going, yeah, too.
That point, actually, the thing that I always really struggle with is having orphaned pages. You know, pages that aren't a part of the information architecture. That feels like an abomination. But actually, with things like landing pages, it makes a lot of sense, you know?
Exactly. And I was thinking, when you said that one, I was also thinking, well, sometimes IAs or the user mental model or the user requirement demands a kind of like maybe an IA that is, you have your kind of standard information architecture, but you also have an information architecture that's that is kind of centered around different user groups, for example. Often in universities, you'll see that.
You read a lot about that. Say, don't build your information architecture around users and user groups. You'll come to regret it. And although I, as a general rule of thumb, I kind of agree with that. I think you can still have secondary forms of navigation. That's what I meant by those landing pages and cross-linking and things like that. I wouldn't build a whole site around audiences, but certainly having a nice, you know, easy place where, for example, with universities, prospective students can find out everything they need in one place, or alumni can, you know.
They're the classic ones, aren't they?
Yeah.
But I took issues too strong. I question the kind of scrap it and start again from scratch approach, which is kind of the ideal, but is it actually realistic? I don't know the answer to this, because where we will usually start, where I will usually start with something like card sorting, is with what you've currently got and just kind of pull it apart and just go,
yeah,
this is your concept. So rather than going down the down the kind of top task route, which is, there's nothing wrong with that, I'm not criticizing that, but it's just like, I hadn't thought of doing it like that. I tend to start with the content that people have got and just try and rearrange it and relabel it and that kind of thing. So
that makes me uncomfortable, if I'm honest, because that makes the assumption they've got the right content.
Yes.
And not only that they've got the content that answers all of user needs, but also that they haven't got content that isn't needed.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, I'm trying not to disagree with what you said, because when you said start by listing all the content types, yep, absolutely, always do that. So it's kind of like, I guess there's maybe a process here when you're doing that initial kind of listing all different content types that you can then compare that to what you've currently got and go, we've got stuff missing here, we need to create that, or that's all, we can just trash that because we've agreed that it's rubbish. But from a kind of like, I don't know, I've just always done it. And I don't know whether it's right or not.
I mean, there is no right or wrong answer as such, is there? Well, I would normally, I do that exercise you just said there, but I tend to do it later. So you know when I talked about creating a very basic kind of wireframe of the site?
Yes.
At that stage, if there is existing content on the existing site, I will link across to it. I'll put a little link in. So just basically grab this content and put it into that page, as a note in the page. And then also I will then do a final pass through the website, the old website, and see if there's anything substantial that's going to disappear from that site if we go to the new one. And then I'll ask myself, well, you know, is that just an oversight on the new site, or is it actually just unnecessary? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. I mean, I suppose the other thing is, you started talking about politics, and I thought, well, what I found is that certain departments they'll actually kind of scream so loud just to ensure that they get something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, but to a certain extent, you know, if we only focus on the user, which you've already said we don't only do that, but you know, you might ignore things like a donation ask or something like that, because most users aren't going to a site with looking for that donation ask. That's a kind of extra thing that the organization is looking to add. So I was thinking of a department in a university that we've worked with, who were very, very kind of voraciously, we must be part of the information architecture, you know, don't ignore us, blah, 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 even though they were kind of actually really kind of small part of it. But I was reminded of them from a political point of view.
I mean,
I'm rambling.
No, you're right. And that's why I talk about, you know, the benefits and the features. But you are right, I didn't really talk very much about calls to action, which I probably should have covered, and also didn't cover like legal requirements, you know, things that you have to have online, because that would be another content type that I didn't mention. Damn, my talk wasn't perfect.
it was very lovely, and I remind that the comment at the end about the students not knowing what alumni means. Brilliant,
yeah.
Because I love saying that. It's almost a pleasure talking to academics at university about that, because they, you can see them wincing. They hate it.
And the other thing that I like is sometimes academics will make comments like, well, if they don't know what the word alumni means, we don't want them at our institution. Oh, I see. So you don't want all of those really valuable Chinese students that don't speak English as their first language. Oh, no, of course we want that. You know, it's great.
Well, can you remember when we worked for a certain Scottish university many, many years ago, and who referred to the word course did not exist on their website.
Oh,
Everything was a program.
Yeah.
And we went out and did testing with users. I think it was even potentially of recently started students who were there taking programs. And none of them knew what it meant in relation to the website situation.
Yeah.
So, yes, happens a lot.
Anyway, let's move on to our little, your little.
My little.
Why is everything little today? I don't know. Your excellent, your vast and comprehensive interview with Abby. I just love this. Anyway, here's the interview.
Okay, this week, as I'm sure we've just introduced you on the previous segment, we've got probably, I don't know whether you're the most famous information architect around, but certainly one of the people who's known for being an information architect, and hence why I asked you onto the show. Hello, Abby. How are you?
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Marcus. It's so good to be back.
I'm not sure how many years ago you were on the show. Probably five, I would have thought. Maybe four or five.
Yeah, it would have to have been at least five, because I wasn't living in Florida yet, I don't think, last time we spoke.
Okay, so
it would have been 4 or 5 years ago, easily.
Okay, if I remember, and this is really stretching my memory, you were living in New York, I think?
Yes. Yep.
Memory skills.
The tiny apartment I've traded in for a tiny jungle in the Florida.
Oh, that's cool. It must be interesting being in Florida at the moment, with mid-COVID and the like.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. We've definitely had some struggles. Our whole country is just really, really struggling right now. So Florida is along with that, and different wave, I guess, than everyone else.
Okay. I mean, yeah, because in such a large country, so already going off on a tangent. I do this just to annoy people. it must be. Yeah, exactly. There can be parts of America that are, improving radically, while others are kind of going downhill because it's so big. I tend to think where we are in the UK, saying that there have been little pockets and certain towns have been locked down. But generally speaking, we appear to be going in the right direction, but who knows? The pubs and restaurants have opened in the last couple of weeks, so that'll be the true test, won't it? A lot of doomsayers are saying, well, that's the end of it. We'll have a second wave very soon. So, well, fingers crossed not.
Yeah, when our restaurants and bars opened in Memorial Day, and we were all like, okay, I guess we'll see what happens. And now we're seeing what happens. So,
Anyway. if I remember rightly, you when you were on the show last time, you had a lot of great things to say about IA and the projects you were working on, the process, but I'm going to be completely honest and say that I can't remember any of the details. So I'm really quite keen to hear what your approaches are again. Well, I can remember it was great. I can remember thinking, this is the kind of thing I do, and you were like showing me new things, and it was great. So, but in those last 5 years, what are you doing now? Who are you working for? Are you still doing kind of going from project to project, or are you on one thing more? What does Abby Covert do these days?
So about 4 years ago, I finally got courted by a client to go full-time that I said yes to. So I decided to go full-time with Etsy. And Etsy is such a great fit for me because from an information architecture standpoint, I mean, I can't think of a bigger challenge than a unique marketplace of all individual sellers with 65 million unique items per sale on any given day. So it's definitely been a bit of a wonderland of messes for me to help to make sense of. So I came onto the team full-time about 3.5 years ago, and I've been working on problems mostly in the inventory understanding space ever since. So really just trying to figure out, like, what are the best structures that we can put in place, knowing that Etsy is going to, for all intents and purposes, continue to be a user-generated content platform forevermore. How do we best use that user-generated content to make things really understandable and really findable? So information architecture has just been a great skill set to apply to that environment for the last few years.
My understanding, and I probably said this when you were on the show last time, my understanding of information architecture, I think, is very... I've spent the last 20 years designing kind of brochure sites, really. I mean, a lot of university sites, but kind of sites that sort of just have a lot of content, and we've just got to organize it into a sensible way that users can kind of get to. So I think my view of information architecture, which I create a structure with labels that are kind of helpful, is really, that's my kind of version of what information architecture is. What does that term mean to you? I guess it might be a bit more.
So I think that you're right on, like, in terms of practical use, information architecture is the way that we've divided the pieces of something to make sense as a whole. So it's the pieces that we've divided out, it's the labels that we've given to those pieces, it's the connection points that we've enabled between those pieces, and sort of the collective feeling that you get when using that is the information architecture. So I think like it's a deceivingly simple thing, Marcus. So you say that. So, oh, well, every project I've ever been, you just decide how to break up the thing and what to call them all. But we've all been in all of those meetings that when you're trying to decide how to break the thing up or what to call the things or how they're going to connect, those are actually really big, critical, strategic conversations that are happening. And information architecture tends to be the skill set that I think is best equipped to lead those conversations really thoughtfully, so that we make sure that we know when we're making decisions about the architecture. Because in a lot of cases, people are having IA conversations about what to call things and where to put things without actually knowing that that's what they're doing. And so they could think that it's a very small thing, like choose a label for right now, but they could run into an understanding issue with their users, an understanding issues with partners, a conflict of meaning with just the term being translated into different languages. Like there's any host of things that can come around in terms of language and structure and complexity. So I think people in a lot of cases do kind of take it for granted that it's very simple to do. But if you look at especially systems at scale, making those decisions is the difference between kind of being future-proofed and not. Which is a really big decision, especially for large organizations in the tech space to be making.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I also, bearing in mind what you've been doing for the last 3 years, I'm not sure, this is a bit of a mean question, but my first question, this relates to the kind of the theme of this series, which is about doing lean UX or UX on a budget, UX if you haven't got a lot of time, and obviously we're talking particularly about information architecture. So do you have different approaches? Because I guess maybe you do, it's like suddenly we've got to panic, we've got to work on this thing and we haven't got a lot of time. So do you have a kind of full version of information architecture that you work on and separately a kind of a leaner version?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So I feel like the interesting thing about information architecture is that no project escapes it as a requirement, right? So like all projects have an information architecture. The thing that you decide in doing a project is whether or not you're going to pay attention to the creation of your information architecture or if you're just going to let it happen. So that's really the decision point that you're after. And so really when you think about like the full versus the lean, I think more in terms of the vision versus the incremental. So I believe very firmly that even when you're doing a small thing, as an information architect, to be responsible about that small thing, you need to be able to zoom out on the problem to see what the next largest context that thing might be encountered in and to make sure that it still works from a solution standpoint. So just that like due diligence part, I think, is a big part of it. But I think when you take that due diligence and then you attach that not only to what you're doing right now, but also admitting that what you're doing right now is either towards or away from a vision of where you're going architecturally, I think that's really where it gets interesting for project teams that are being asked to work really quickly. You can be asked to work really quickly and just start moving with no vision, which can get you into a real pickle pretty quickly, or you can move really quickly while taking that first cycle to really think about that vision so that you know that you're jumping off from the right kind of place of agreement with the rest of the team. So in my work, I do tend to advocate for that position where, yes, we can move quickly, but let's at least take the pause at the beginning to understand strategically what that means, what that quickness will mean. And if that quickness means we are operating with no vision, so be it. We'll still try to make the thing work the way that we need it to work in the moment. But let's at least admit to ourselves that the thing we're doing is throwaway work, that it's a stopgap. And I find sometimes just having the power in the team to acknowledge that can just alleviate some of the concerns that you get from folks that don't want to act irresponsibly. You know, they want to know that we're going towards something. So if you can say, oh, no, we're going towards something, here it is, that's the ultimate. But if you can't, the next best thing is to say, we know we're not going towards anything, but we need to get this done for these reasons. And because of that, just give it just that much energy and attention. You don't need to continue to give it all of the energy and attention to try to make it into the ultimate. So I find like getting to that decision really quickly with folks between that like incremental versus vision conversation, that seems to be more what it is, as opposed to like two different ways of doing information architecture. One as like penultimate white whale project and the other like, you know, smaller, more realistic tactical projects.
Okay. My next question, I guess, is kind of connected in the question is, if your time and budget is limited, what do you think is the most important thing you should concentrate on? Is that basically, you know, take a bit of time at the start before you dive in? Or is there, a specific process that you go through?
So there's two areas that I would invest the most heavily in. One is on understanding your teammates and like the environment that you're working in, whether that's your stakeholder, your client, your colleagues, whatever the environment is. Like taking the time to invest and really understanding where all of those different people are coming from on this problem space, I find that that's an investment that will always pay off dividends. And then the second space is in understanding your users' mental models. So if you have, you know, just one day to put into research on a project, that's where I would put it. It's on understanding how does your user think about the thing that you're making? Not how do they use it, not what do they complain about it, what do they think about it in terms of how it fits into their life, into the task they're trying to accomplish, and then how does it kind of work or not work in those contexts today? I find that that's an exercise that most teams can do fairly quickly at like a high level. But I find that that investment sometimes isn't made when you don't have permission to go to that next lower level. So I see that activity being deprioritized when really, if you match that user understanding with your stakeholder understanding, I mean, you're just starting from a really strong position of agreement across all of the various audiences. So I think that that's probably what a lot of teams are missing, and also the best place for small teams to be starting.
That's really interesting, because I've tended to find, and I've got a particular project in mind that I did working with a hospital last year, where I've tended to find that you get a lot of buy-in at this stage from internal stakeholders, particularly if you're working for an external client. It's something they understand. It's something they kind of feel they can kind of put their hooks into and provide value, and they can. But what I've found is that they don't feel it's necessary to maybe get that user buy-in. So therefore, I can remember kind of fighting, again is too strong, but kind of fighting against this kind of, our users understand these terms. And a lovely one, they had a big home icon in their navigation, and this came up as part of the conversation about information architecture. And I said, you know, we can't assume that your users understand that that means kind of return to homepage. Very specific example here, but there were others as well. Anyway, I'm rabbiting on. Have you got any kind of methods or ways of ensuring that you don't go down those rabbit holes, or people just going, well, no, of course everyone understands what we're talking about here?
Yeah, I think that this is one of the big teaching opportunities on a lot of projects I find myself on. I think that there is something really wicked about the idea of common sense, right? Like, it's common sense that that home icon means home, and it's common sense that, you know, the word contact will be clear to every person that you ever put it in front of in terms of that means where you find your email address. Like, there's these patterns that we seem to want to rely on as infallible. And in all cases that I can think of, there are cases that fail in all of those patterns. So I'm really a firm believer in not falling victim to patterning. And I find that in a lot of cases, clients really need to be, or colleagues need to be brought along on this journey of understanding that common sense is not all that common, that a common is actually is subjective, and that common has to be defined as to who you're speaking about, because a common pediatrician is going to have a different language than a common plumber. And we don't know who we're building this website for unless we start to have those conversations, and unless we have a really strong user base internally to kind of play some of those ideas off of, it's really risky to make decisions based on our own mental models of these things versus our users. And even if we do have users internally, and this is something that I find at Etsy we have to talk a lot about, it's like we have a lot of employees that are both you know, kind of classic Etsy buyers, and then also we have people that have their own shops on Etsy. That doesn't mean that they are the same as Etsy sellers and buyers externally that don't work in the organization. And I think that, like, that understanding of bias and like that basic kind of research principle of understanding bias is something that, you know, we as practitioners really have to teach to some folks that don't have that as part of their skill set and don't understand the inherent value of that. And sometimes I find that the best way to teach that lesson is by showing it. So, you know, unfortunately, it's sort of the chicken and the egg of, if you're trying to get the investment into the research, it can be really difficult to get them to say yes enough to see it. But I try to encourage at least those that I mentor to get that first research interaction to be small enough that it's not risky, that it's just like a little, oh, we're just going to talk to a couple people about a couple things. But then the knowledge that you bring out of that teaches that lesson. So it's not necessarily a study you have to invest a lot in about like the future of the thing you're working on. It's just a little study that's just meant to show, you know, little things like not understanding a term. And there's methodologies from the IA toolset that can be really useful there. Like, if you watch a user doing card sorting on a prescribed taxonomy, you know, let your colleague that thinks that they can design the taxonomy for the thing that you're designing, let them do it and then put it in front of 5 users and watch them not be able to find the things that they were looking for or classify the things that way. And that's like an immediate moment where you can sort of have that knowledge that you knew before they did, that you need users, which is also a really delicate moment because you can crush it at that point. You can ruin the trust that you've just built by doing the told you so dance and saying, I told you that they didn't understand it. I told you users are different. So like you have to, as a practitioner, you have to keep yourself from that as well. Like you have to really take it into yourself as a teacher, but like to let them have that moment and have the knowledge that they didn't know that before. And now that they do, they can go forward with that and then let them, you know, prove you right, that they'll start to think from a user-centered perspective from there forward. I've seen stranger things happen.
There are so many examples of this, aren't there? I can't remember who it was. Somebody, I think it was working, was new head of design at Twitter 10 years ago, let's say, a long, long time ago, back in the midst of time. And they were speaking somewhere and I was watching live in the audience. And the same thing happened with their designers. He made them all sit down and watch people using the designs. And there was this kind of like mind-blown moment of like, oh, right. Yes, I get it now.
Yeah, it works with end users as much as it works with your colleagues. Like we recently did a bit of an investment into user testing for some of our internal things, and we watched our coworkers using these things, and it was mind blowing. I mean, at the beginning of the project, I think that you know a couple people on the project were a little bit like, oh, why are we doing that? We already know the problem. Like it's yeah. We've read the documents. We know what they're complaining about, what they want changed, what their feature requests are. But then to watch them actually go through it and see like what their struggle is and to kind of like put yourself into their position, it just changes your own perspective in a way that it actually changes your mental model of the problem, which allows you to make better decisions and more thoughtful ones.
Great. Okay, I'm going to move on to kind of like geeky tool type stuff. Are there any kind of special tools that you use to share your IA ideas or anything like that, things that listeners should be aware of?
So I am definitely in a Google Docs shop. So Etsy is like 100% Google Drive all the time. So I work in public. All of my docs are available for my coworkers to see at any moment. I don't do the like go into the Batcave and big reveal for the presentation. I'm a big believer in pre-reads. So anytime that I'm going to be talking at you for a half hour, you will have had the opportunity to read what I'm going to say beforehand, which is something I firmly believe in. And then in terms of tools, I would say my tool chest is pretty light. I would say that I'm more about frameworks and less about tools. So I collect frameworks like a nerd from pretty much anyone giving a talk or showing their work. I'm always seeing like a new diagram format or matrix format that I want to play with.
Okay.
But then in terms of tooling, I would say like the most special tools to me are probably the ones in the research world. From like the IA standpoint, I would say what Optimal Workshop is providing at a low cost version of for like free card sorting, live tree jack testing, like all of these are just really critical tools. Mm-hmm. So if any of your audience is not familiar with that tool set, I just find that they're just so valuable. And testing IA at scale asynchronously is something that a lot of teams will get a lot of value out of. And then other than that, I've been really diving recently into the world of product management. So I'm taking a little rotation at Etsy, learning what it's like to be a product manager. I'm on part of our system. And so I'm really like turning my focus towards that world a little bit and starting to read their books and watch their conference talks and that kind of thing. So more to come on that in terms of tools. Not sure if there's any PM tools to recommend just yet.
Okay, cool. To finish, this is the classic kind of almost like what's your favorite color question, but if you had one piece of advice for someone embarking on an IA project, what would it be?
One piece of advice. I'm going to go with be the filter and not the grounds. So this is a metaphor that I wrote about in my book about information architecture. Mm-hmm. Really, I feel like in so many cases, the information architecture role is coming into a charged environment where there's lots of opinions and lots of mental model differences between the people you're working with and the people you're serving and the people that are maybe building the thing. And these are all different audiences. I find that if you come into those kinds of situations as another person with more opinions and more, you know, stuff to sort out, you're just kind of adding to the mess versus if you can actually set aside yourself and your own kind of biases and opinions, even temporarily, which is very, very difficult to do in all reality. But if you can pretend to be able to set those things aside and really focus on being the sense maker for other people's vision, I think that you can just get so much work done. And so, yeah, I would encourage people to really think about that metaphor. And like in a charged conversation, especially, like try to think, am I being the filter or am I being the coffee grounds right now? And which one do I need to be in this moment? Because it feels really good to be the work product. But in my experience, it feels better to be the device that allows it all to happen at all, you know, because there's this yucky, icky, gross, gritty coffee without that filter. Yeah. Nobody wants to drink that.
That is fantastic advice. And yeah, something I struggle with. Always going in with like, we need to go here and we need to go there. And actually, no, I need to shut up and let people work it out.
And this is something that happens, you know, when I mentor folks that are coming up in their careers, I think that there's a lot of self-esteem stuff that's baked into that too. You know, we all want to be the smartest person in the room. We all want to feel like we're valued. We all want to feel like our salary is for a reason, like that people think we're worth what we're being paid or the respect we're being given or whatever. But I think that sometimes we let that go too far and we let it get in the way of actually understanding each other and doing really good work. So you got to like set that aside and like, be okay with that. Maybe the value that you're bringing is not in your ideas. It's actually in your ability to clarify other people's ideas, which I think there's something really special about that.
Yeah, being a facilitator. Well, thank you, Abby, so much. That was great. Again, I really, really appreciate you giving us the time.
Awesome. This was great. Anytime.
Oh, I just love Abby because she's so pragmatic, isn't she? Right. Mm-hmm. You know, and she, the whole thing about, well, if you need to take shortcuts, that's fine. You know, as long as you know you're doing it. That was the thing that made real, that I really loved.
I wasn't expecting her to go there either. I was expecting her to sort of like insist that, no, you must have this particular process in place. And if it's not, then you cut the net and then whatever you agreed is invalid, blah, blah, blah. Actually, no, just as long as you're aware.
I think that doesn't just apply to IA. I think it applies to UX as a whole.
Yes.
It's okay to take shortcuts as long as you know you're doing it, and as long as everyone's in agreement that that's what you're doing. Brilliant. So the other thing that I like that she said is I love the fact that you can't avoid IA, right? And that you know, you are going to create an information architecture whether you want to or not, so you might as well invest some time in getting it right, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously there's no such thing as common sense. That was just so, that made me laugh out loud because it's so true. You know, what one person's common sense is and another's is just two very different things. So,
yes, really very, very wise.
Yeah. And then what was it? The facilitator point right at the end, I thought that was very, I mean, it was you that used the word facilitator, but this idea that we need to stop thinking of ourselves as the genius that has to come up with all the solutions.
Yeah. Genius is maybe too strong,
yeah,
but all right. It's because both you and I are guilty of this.
Yeah,
we both want to go in and right, I'm here, it'll all be fine, da da da, look, you know, we'll do great stuff today and I'll be in charge, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And actually no, just shut up and just guide people, because they're the ones that know, you don't, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I'm making this too black and white, but it's kind of like, yeah, I couldn't agree more. Best point of all I thought she made.
Yeah.
It's just, yes, you are the facilitator in a situation like that. It is not your content. It's not your website. You're the person trying to make this great thing happen. So,
yeah.
Wonderful.
Wonderful stuff indeed. Right, let's move on to our little aside that we do each time with the guys from Balsamic. It's a really good one this week, so we'll dive straight into that. Okay, so we've got Leon here from Balsamic with us. Hello, Leon. How are you doing?
Hi, good to be back.
Yeah, it's always good to have you with you. And we're talking about wireframing today, which is very appropriate because in my little talk that I gave earlier in the podcast, I was talking about how the sooner you can start prototyping and wireframing things up with information architecture, then the more that you can start to test and that kind of stuff. But what we're talking about with you is quite an interesting one, which is how we should include other people in wireframing. We shouldn't just see it as a design thing. And so let's start by, you know, answering the question as to why people like product managers and executives should be doing wireframing. You know, what's wrong with, I don't know, the way that they communicate as it is with documents and meetings and things like that? Why do they need to start wireframing?
Yeah, that's an excellent way to start it off. Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of product managers, for example, or entrepreneurs, startup founders, you know, they come up through through business school, maybe, and, you know, almost everything there is in, you know, written communication, verbal communication, maybe presentations. It's kind of all this standing up in front of the boardroom or emailing things around kind of way. But, you know, if you think about kind of this idea of the product manager as the idea person, then you think of maybe somebody with, you know, using a napkin to sketch out an idea. And, you know, typically they have this idea that's in their head and they can even picture it. So, you know, but they kind of have this idea that they're not allowed to draw pictures because that's too, I don't know, that's out of their domain or something. So, but I think it's fine for people who are these idea people to be communicating visually.
I totally agree with that. I mean, the trouble is it's so easy to misunderstand other ways of communication. You know, if it's, I write in a document, I don't know, that we, you know, that we should have a carousel, for example. What I mean by a carousel, what I'm picturing that carousel as being and what you're picturing it is two completely different things. So actually visualizing it in some way makes such a difference, doesn't it?
Exactly.
So when you talk about in the article that we'll link back to in the show notes, you talk about this idea of wireframing as a thinking tool. What are you driving at there? What's your thinking behind that?
Yeah, again, it's kind of trying to get product managers and people like that to be a little bit more creative, I guess. And a lot of times you don't know, you think that you have your idea perfectly kind of fleshed out in your head, but only when you start to actually see it on paper or on a screen do you realize what you know and what you don't know. So if you just start sketching it out, if you start trying to visualize it, you'll realize what parts of it are maybe incomplete. And then that leads you, that kind of prompts you to fill in the rest of it. And it just kind of engages a different part of your brain to help you kind of start drawing and start thinking. But it has to be really low friction, kind of like sketching on a napkin or something, which is why you don't want to use a tool that's too intimidating or overwhelming, or you feel like, oh, I'm afraid to touch something because I might break it or I might get into something that I'm not comfortable in. So, you know, and that's why I like wireframing, because it's kind of like pen and paper, but it's less intimidating because you don't feel like you have to draw.
Yeah. And that is a big part of it, that I think a lot of people find drawing incredibly intimidating. If you're a non-designer, the number of people who say, I can't draw, so therefore I can't do this kind of thing. How do people get over that feeling?
Yeah, it's really ingrained, and I think it's a challenge. My team at Balsamiq, we recently came up with a process, a 5-step process for non-designers to kind of use wireframing and just make it a little less intimidating. Two of the interviews that we did earlier this season were about content-first design and also how to start a wireframe project. And the whole idea behind those is to make it less intimidating, more approachable by starting with something that you already know. Maybe you already have some copy or some content for the page, or you have some inspiration that you can use, and or you know a little bit about who's going to be using it. So just something to get you over that. That kind of roadblock of going from nothing to something. So those are actually kind of captured in what we call the articulate and the generate steps, which are the first two steps in these process. They kind of help you focus on the problem rather than being hung up on what's it going to look like. And then there's a step after that, which is called iterate. And that means kind of consolidate those ideas into something that you can then use or get somebody else involved, you know, kind of accept those limitations and say, well, I may not be so visual, but I have something down. And as long as you have something that's kind of that you can look at and show to somebody else, then you can get them involved and start, you know, adding or rearranging the controls or starting to build up the user interface, whether you're building in the developer who or using the developer who knows a little bit more about the technology, or maybe a designer who's going to help you with the UI a little bit, or somebody who really has a lot of domain knowledge. And then the final two steps in our little five-step process are communicate and validate. And basically, you know, a design is not done until you've communicated it to the stakeholders, whether that's a client or the people who are going to be building it, or marketing, customer support. Make sure everybody understands that idea and gets a chance to give their input on it. Because again, the whole idea with this whole process of wireframing or just design in general is that you don't want to have any surprises, and you want to get as much of the your ideas kind of vetted before you move on to coding. Mm. And then this last step is to validate it. So really go back to the beginning and say, are we really solving this problem for our users? You know, did we think about all the use cases and that sort of thing? So these five steps to kind of make wireframing less intimidating for non-designers are articulate, generate, iterate, communicate, and validate. Try to make them simple and all kind of rhyme a little bit so that they're easier easier to remember. So that's kind of the background of the goal of this article that I wrote.
And I think it's a really good observation that you don't just kind of designers don't go into a room and do some kind of black magic and design just pops out the other end. You know, there is a process. There are steps that anybody can learn and anybody can take. And in terms of the actual, yeah, but I don't know how to sketch or draw things kind of stuff, we're not talking about highly refined designs here. We're talking about, you know, basic things. And that's why a tool like Balsamiq works really well, because you can just drag and drop a carousel or drag and drop a list or whatever. You don't need to, you know, be incredibly artistic to do any of this stuff. So good, encouraging message, Leon. Absolutely love it. Thank you very much for coming on, as always. All right, good stuff, loved it. It's always a pleasure talking to Leon. He always talks a lot of sense, and I completely agree that more people should be wireframing. It shouldn't just be designers that get to do it. So
can I make a contentious point on that, even though I haven't heard what the whole thing was about?
Oh great, yeah, that works really well.
I've got a bit of an issue with non-designers wireframing along the lines of, and it's not that the non-designers wireframing is bad, it's just that often that can then be taken as, well, that's the kind of, that's the layout for the website, done.
Yeah.
And do you know what I mean? And it's like, yeah, actually what a designer wants is a kind of prioritized bullet point list rather than a wireframe of boxes. And, you know, there's a little bit of a balance there. Sometimes you have to do wireframes of boxes and pages to kind of visualize things. But it's kind of like we need to be wary of that, I suppose, because we can end up with people who aren't designers designing things, basically.
That's contentious. And you make – it's an excellent point, and I fully agree with it. And I think a lot of it comes down to how you've prepared the ground in situations like that. I like to involve people in wireframing who aren't designers, because the more they contribute, the more that they get involved, the greater a sense of ownership they have over something, and therefore the more likely they are to approve the final thing and be on board and all of those kinds of stuff. So I think the benefits outweigh the drawbacks, but you need to position that wireframing that you do with the client or the stakeholder as thinking out loud, exploring ideas, you know. And that's actually a phrase that Leon uses in his piece. He talks about wireframing being thinking out loud, you know. It's visualizing what's going on in your head. Doesn't mean we're going to be doing it, doesn't mean it's going to be the final thing. It's just an opportunity to explore ideas in a visual way where it's easier for everybody to understand exactly what's being said. Cool. So, yeah, it was good.
Don't disagree with any of that. Just felt the need to chirp up as ever.
Absolutely. All right. So that wraps up this show pretty much. The next time we're going to be looking at low fidelity wireframing with stakeholders. So actually building on what we've already started with Leon this time around. And it will be out on the end of August.
End of August, yes.
So, Marcus, do you want us to wrap us up with a joke?
This is one from Gary Delaney. I stole a neck brace from hospital. I feel kind of bad, but at least I can hold my head up high.
That's quite good. I like that one. I've discovered that you can be replaced by Google.
Oh, good.
My Google Home tells jokes.
Oh, yes, so does Alexa.
Yeah, we ought to try it. So, hey, Google, tell us a joke.
Prepare to chuckle or groan. Why did the man get fired from the calendar factory? Because he tried to take a month off.
Ha ha.
It's even got canned laughter at the end of it.
I could there shout at Alexa, but we wouldn't hear her. She's in a different room.
Oh, well, that's no good then. All right. Yeah, perhaps we ought to do a comparison next time around. Well, I'll do a Google Home one. You do an Alexa one. And we'll see who's got the better joke.
Sounds great.
We're never going to remember that anyway. All right. Until next month, thank you very much for listening. And goodbye.
Bugrub.com.